You're listening to Truth Quest with Melody on KHEN LPFM Radio, 106.9 Salida, Colorado. We are streamed on the internet at khen.org, and Truth Quest programs are archived at www.gimmesometruth.info. My co-host today is Dr. Eric Carlstrom, a professor of geography at California State University at Stanislaus with nearly 30 years of teaching experience. His academic research has focused on using ancient soils, paleosols, and landforms as a means of reconstructing climates and environmental conditions of the past. And his website is www.naturalclimatechange.us. And Eric, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, I'll just let you go ahead and introduce our guest.
Okay, well, it's a real pleasure and honor for me to introduce our guest today. This is Dr. George Kukla, who is, I think, one of the world's experts, real experts on climates of the past, a study that we can call paleoclimatology. Let me just read you a little bit of what it says in his Wikipedia blurb. Sorry, George, this is what I have in front of me. It says, George Kukla is a retired professor of climatology at Columbia University and a researcher at the Lamont Doherty Earth Laboratory, or Observatory.
Observatory, yeah.
Yeah. Dr. Kukla was a member of the Czechoslovakian Academy of Sciences prior to emigrating to the U.S. and a pioneer in the field of astronomical climate forcing. In 1972, he became a central figure in convincing the United States government to take the dangers of climate change seriously. Kukla and geologist Robert Matthews of Brown University convened a historic conference themed The Present Interglacial, How and When Will It End? Kukla and Matthews then highlighted the dangers of global cooling in Science magazine and to President Richard Nixon. The Nixon administration reacted swiftly to their letter, which described calamities such as killer frost, lower food production, and floods to come. By February 1973, the State Department had established a panel on the present interglacial, which advised Drs. Kukla and Matthews that it was, quote, seized of the matter, unquote, and numerous other governmental agencies were soon included. Kukla was co-author of a chapter in the book Natural Climate Variability on Decade-to-Century Timescales, published by the National Research Council. Kukla believes all glacial periods in Earth's history began with global warming, understood as an increase of area-weighted average global mean temperature. He believes Earth's recent warming is mostly natural and will ultimately lead to a new ice age. Okay, and then it gives some links to various articles that feature you or that you wrote. So George Kukla is famous enough to have a Wikipedia entry, and people can go online and read some of the material on about him. George, perhaps welcome to our two-hour interview, and perhaps the way to start would be to ask you to tell us how you got interested in the subject of climate change and your academic background in that field.
No, what's the question?
My question is, you grew up in Czechoslovakia, but you became an expert on climate changes over time, and so I just wondered about your academic background, where you got your degrees, how you got interested in this subject.
Oh, I see. No, so I studied at the Charles University in Prague, right, where I received in 1971, I guess, I received a doctorate title, yeah. And I didn't do any more studying here in America. The reason why I disappeared from Czech Republic, because of the political situation there, no? The country was under the communist rule. So we just escaped with the whole family using the invitation, because fortunately we got the invitation from the American National Science Foundation, which in those days invited the foreigners, they were interested in having here in America to help the local teaching at the local universities here in America. Okay?
Yeah, and then you have been involved as a researcher at the Lamont Doherty.
Since that time, yes, I am working at Lamont, yeah.
Okay, I recall when I was getting my PhD back in the late 70s on the glacial history of Alberta and Montana that you had written a paper for Quaternary Science Reviews in 1977 called Pleistocene Land-Sea Correlation,
yes.
In which you pretty much tied up the whole climatic history of what we would call the Pleistocene epoch or the Quaternary period, the last 2.5 million years or so, which would be the present ice age, and
yeah.
Correlated land records and sea records with the Milankovitch astronomic theory of climate change. So that was kind of a breakthrough in terms of our understanding of climate cycles and how these have been forced by variations in the Earth's orbit around the sun, as predicted by this Milutin Milankovitch back in the 30s, I believe, a mathematician. And so you have tremendous experience with the Czechoslovakian lust sequence, the Chinese lust sequence, the deep sea core records, and you've looked around the world at all kinds of climatic, paleoclimatic records. So could you briefly tell us a little bit about that research?
That's true, but listen, Eric, even in those days that you described no long ago, I didn't realize the funniest part of that whole process, of that Milankovitch process, because Milankovitch was very interested in the high latitudes, and he just didn't underline sufficiently the fact that the low latitudes are doing the opposite than the high latitudes, that actually when high latitudes are cooling and producing the glacier snow and the snow accumulating and ice growing all over the place, that actually the tropics are warming. And it's because the tropics have half of the global area. So the global mean temperature compared to the relatively small area of the subpoles. So the global mean temperature is growing. Yeah. And the ice at the time is already starting the glacial advance. So it took me a while to figure out how it works. And even now it's considered a kind of sort of contradiction to realize that the most benign part of the Holocene, for example, and of the interglacial was actually the time of the relatively low global mean temperature, the aerially weighted global mean temperature. And on the other hand, since then, it's increasing, the temperature is increasing. So Al Gore is right, you see, we are now having the very relatively high global mean temperature. Yeah, but it's run basically by the tropics. The tropics, maybe I can give you the figures just from the last 50 years, now from 1950 to 2010 and now, when we can really take relatively seriously even the ocean temperatures, now, which were not so well known before. But anyway, during these last 50 years or 60 years now, yeah, so in 1976, we had the relatively very low temperature. Thus, the global mean temperature was almost at the lowest point. And in 1998 was, on the other hand, the warmest year. So the difference of the global mean temperature between those two times is 9 degrees Celsius. Whereas if you look at the just tropical belt between 23.6 north and 23.6 south, so there the difference is 13.5 degrees Celsius. So it is the tropics, the tropical oceans, which are basically running the global warming, if you can take it this way. And we have this study of my Columbia colleagues here at Columbia University who are studying the El Niño and La Niña variations in the tropical oceans. And they realize that actually the El Niños, no, the warm extremes, El Niños, are marked or are at the same time showing the peak, the warmest global mean temperature. Not only the tropics, El Niño is the tropical happening, but it actually is running it's pushing the global mean temperature, the whole globe averaged, aerially averaged, to the highest point. And on the other hand, La Niña is doing the opposite. And since up to now, we had more or less the equal number, during this 50 or 60 last years. So we had about one third of Las Niñas, one third of El Niños, so the cold and warm anomalies on the other hand, and one third was just, let's call it normal. So that's showing that warming is really pushed up by frequent or more frequent appearances of El Niño compared to La Niña. And that's basically the tropics, the tropical oceans are governing what's happening to the global mean temperature. Is that understandable?
Yeah, I think so. And I'm glad we're starting with the recent past, and I, we'll probably take it back further. There's another geologist by the name of Don Easterbrook who...
I know him, yes.
He mentions 30-year cycles and correlates these with the...
Pacific. Oh, yeah, now they are shorter cycles, because what I am talking to you is here and there, thousands of years. I don't care. But, this is the longer... term variability. Yeah, they are many shorter sub-cycles, let's call it that way, okay?
Yeah, and he's correlating with the Pacific Decadal Oscillation.
Sure, yeah. Right,
yeah, and that you would find consistent with what you're saying about El Niño and La Niña.
Yeah, right.
Okay, so you see the Pacific Ocean then, and the changes in the temperature and the wind patterns, especially over the tropical Pacific, as driving the temperature on the surface of the Earth.
And remember what we listen. If you want to build a really nice ice volume, ice sheet in the high latitudes, either in the Greenland or in Antarctica, you need a difference in temperature being as high as possible between the tropics and between those subpoles, okay?
Yeah, the temperature gradient needs to increase.
The gradient, yeah. The gradient is actually driving the global climate, if you want.
Okay. Well, based on your understanding of the Milankovitch cycles, which is which there are three of them, which were computer calculated by this Serbian mathematician,
yes.
Milutin Milankovitch. They have periodicities of about 100,000 years, 40,000 years, and 20,000 years, more or less. And these kind of team up to result in differences in the amount of solar radiation directed at different latitudes on the Earth.
Yes.
And we know now enough about past climates through our understanding of deep sea cores and ice cores, et cetera, lake cores, to kind of figure out where we are now in the Milankovitch cycle. And would you care to mention where we are now in terms of the longer term climate cycles that Milankovitch calculated?
Well, we actually were at the Milankovitch predicted start of that warm, that relatively benign episode of the integration. You know, it's obvious, and it was marked by the relatively high obliquity. The obliquity is the measure of the. Let's you can easily blame it for the elevation of the sun over the poles, right? So where it's 24 and something degrees, 24.3 degrees, it was at the beginning of our integration, Holocene. So it was relatively very high. And as a result, during the year, the large part of the solar energy is, so to say, wasted in the high latitudes where there is so much, you know, snow and the reflection from the snow is losing the energy coming, you know, solar energy coming to the Earth. So it's funny. It's a kind of, you know, waste of what we are getting from the sun. But on the other hand, the gradient between the poles and the tropical oceans is relatively small. So there isn't that much of movement of the water, evaporated water, toward the polar areas. And that's the situation at the beginning of the interglacials.
And now, where are we in the whole Milankovitch cycles now?
No, we are farther. We are not as far on the to the other extreme than we were, for example, in the comparable period at the start of the last glaciation, like some 115,000 years ago. In the 115,000 years ago, this obliquity was only 22.4, I guess, degrees. So, relatively very low. And in the situation of the low obliquity, you have the tropical ocean getting most of the available sunshine. So they are warming. They are considerably warmer than the other times. And on the other hand, the high latitudes are on the other extreme. They are cooler. You know, they have a smaller area, so that they don't count that much if you compute the aerially averaged global mean temperature. That's the point.
Okay. Let me just throw out a couple terms. It's very interesting that yourself, as a climate scientist and a geologist, would be extremely familiar with these terms, and myself and anybody that studies this stuff, and yet these terms don't seem to make it into the popular press, even though the issue of global warming has taken on such a huge significance in terms of policy and the future of the economy and everything. But the basic terms are that we are now in an ice age. It's called the Quaternary period. It's comprised of about the last 2.6 million years, during which time the Earth has fluctuated between much colder temperatures during glacial climates and climates that are about the same as now or a little warmer, called interglacial climates. The last 10,000 years, called the Holocene epoch, coincides with an interglacial.
We are
in a relatively warm period right now, and the question is, are we going to continue to warm catastrophically, as some would claim, or are
if it should be catastrophic or not. It happened in the past, and on the other hand, it didn't look like a red catastrophe. Now, we are going to continue the growth of the aerially weighted global mean temperature, okay? And that's from maybe the industry is a little bit contributing, but the process itself is absolutely natural, okay? And this should continue still for, it looks like for several thousand years before we get to the point at which the last glaciation started. So we are having still pretty good expectation of the relatively okay climate.
The Holocene, the present interglacial, or the last 10,000 years, is commonly considered to be a period of relative warmth and stability.
Milankovitch cycles, long cycles of about 100,000 years each, and every first of the four such cycles. So let's say we are now going to repeat principally in the natural terms, on the natural climate change, forgetting what the human input would be. So we are repeating, let's say, the Earth's experience from like 400,000 years ago. And that indeed started with about 30,000 years of warm, relatively interglacial type of climate.
This would be what we call the Holstein climate in Europe, is that correct? Or the Holstein interglacial?
Which one? I don't.
There were 400,000 years ago. This would be a period of greater warmth than today, a long warm period, a long interglacial, which was sea levels were a little bit higher, and it was globally a little warmer than today. Is that correct?
No, it wasn't considerably warm. No, the warmth was the ocean were more or less as they are today. So no, it wasn't exceptionally warm, but it was exceptionally long.
Okay.
There wasn't that kind of sudden cooling switch. Principally important in this respect is what will happen to the frequency of El Niños and La Niñas, because maybe you don't realize it, but in the last 55 years, the average of El Niños was the global mean temperature being considerably warmer, by about 1 degree warmer than the normal one, so to say. Whereas with the Las Niñas, it was the other way. It was considerably cooler. Yeah, so when you switch, that switch is sooner or later it should come. We don't know exactly when. But when we switch from more frequent Las Niñas, the cold type of Niñas, to the Los Niños, the El Niños, no, to the warm extremes in the tropics. So that's when we have a sudden cooling, or a relatively rapid, within 1,000 years or so, cooling. And that is, who knows when it will come.
So you're saying an exceptionally warm El Nino can throw us into a cooler climate?
Exceptionally frequent, more frequent El Nino than La Nina would throw us into the cooler climate, yeah. Funny, okay. No?
Yeah, it is. And George, how
funny. Yes, but that's how it is.
What do you attribute?
It's a little counterintuitive that the interglacials start with a pronounced cooling, and the glacials start with pronounced warming, which has been your
if you look at the aerially average global mean temperature, what the people are doing now, and it's stupid. Yeah.
What do you attribute that frequency to? Is there anything that it can be tracked at?
I now don't hear you well. Say it again.
What do you attribute the frequency?
No, it's a very miserable connection. Right now, I don't know what happened.
Sorry.
Okay, I hear the question.
Now it's George. Fine.
I hear the question, and basically she's saying, to what do you attribute the El Niño-La Niña cycle? And that's a good question, and what happens, and what is the periodicity of that cycle? Do you have and how far back can we trace the El Niño La Niña?
Well, on the average, El Niño, which is the warm anomaly, no? So in the tropical oceans, is followed by La Niña, which is the other extreme, no? So in about 5 to 7 years are the differences, are the frequencies.
Yeah, let me just say a little bit about that. Our understanding of El Niño and La Niña is still rather incomplete. It has a relatively poor periodicity, is somewhere between 7 and 10 years.
That's
or,
very,
yeah, and
that's
we're right. Just coming out of an El Niño year. We had a big one in 1998. We had a real big one in 82, 83.
Okay, yeah, that was a really top El Niño, 1998. And then this one seems to be pretty good as well. I mean, in January and what, you know, that should be a pretty good El Niño. And now the funniest thing is that if it's not the highest one in, let's say, the last decades, so it's at least a pretty good one, and that means that the global mean annually averaged, you see. Temperature would be relatively high, and you remember the snows that we had in January down in whatever in the southern latitudes. It was considered pretty exceptionally cold situation down there, but you know that makes very little difference if you. Just weigh it by the area of the whole globe.
Yeah, let me just say a little bit more about El Niño and La Niña for our listeners, because it's probably not common knowledge. During an El Niño year, the trade winds down near the equator, which blow from east to west, the southeast
no,
and the northeast trades,
no,
weaken. And then you get, it's called the ENSO, El Niño Southern Oscillation. You get a reversal of the ocean current so that instead of following the winds blowing from east to west, the currents actually go from west to east, which brings very warm pools of water, say, from the West Pacific over to the East Pacific. So off the west coast of North America and South America, for instance, you have a warm pool of water, which causes more storminess, more evaporation, and a lot more rain along the west coast of South and North America.
Yeah, that's what we see in the tropics, because in the tropics, on the tropical oceans in the Pacific, that's where it's most pronounced, right? But it's interesting that it actually affects the weather, the climate all over the globe.
Yeah.
There are changes all over.
Do you see a correlation, George? Now, we're talking very high-frequency climate change here with El Niño and La Niña, and, of course, the Milankovitch cycle.
You mean
much,
those 5 to 7 years now, or what?
Yeah. So do you see any correlation whatsoever between Milankovitch forcing or astronomical variations in
yes,
the Earth's orbit?
Yes, it is. Yeah, it's the work of the researcher Amy Clement and the people here at Lamont Observatory as well, working with her, you know, like Mike Kane and others. There's a whole group of people actually using this kind of predictions based basically on the models to predict ahead the frequency of RNV for practical purposes, you know, for shipping and so on. And it's working very well. And NOAA actually is using these predictions. And according to these models, to the models that these people are using, so the switch from more frequent Las Niñas to more frequent El Niños is more or less for some time really difficult to go the other way. It's when it happens, that's it. And then for like 10 or 15,000 years, it's that the one type of that variability is more frequent than the other. And during the interglacials, the whole time of that interglacial, the Las Niñas, the cold version, was more frequent than the warm one.
That also is counterintuitive, isn't it?
That's funny, but that's what it was. It's more or less by observations of what's going on now, it's almost proved by those observations. That's how it was.
What's the basis for that conclusion, George? What's the evidence for the fact that over 10 or 15,000 year cycles you might get a more frequent La Niñas or Las Niñas and then in the next 10 or 15,000
Unfortunately, years? Okay, this is based only on the models. Frankly, you know, what we know today about the so-called global mean temperature is we hope that it's very close to global mean temperature, but let's say up to 1950, maybe it's really relatively solid. But what's before 1950, and especially before 1900, come on, we don't know too much.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. In fact, there are some scientists who would say that it's extremely difficult, even today, to get one number as a global average temperature because you're
exactly. I would subscribe to it as well.
Yeah, because what you're doing is you're taking measurements from climate stations in various parts of the world. They're not evenly distributed. The oceans, for instance, have up till recently not had such
as furthermore, where we do have the stations in a sufficient density, okay, like in Europe and in America. So, come on. The morning temperatures, it depends pretty much on how far are you from the center of the city where, you know, everybody is eating and whatever. No, those are, especially the daily lows are very affected by the population density.
Yeah,
so, you know, those are just, who knows?
Yeah, there's a couple of meteorologists whose names I can't remember, but they went back and looked at all the meteorological data from the climate stations in America, and they tried to take out the stations that could be affected by what they call the urban heat island, or proximity to urbanized areas. And when they took those stations out, then all of a sudden the amount of warming in the 20th
Carl,
century dropped.
For example, from our from North. That's right. So we were trying to do it, but come on. You know. We were very unsure how effective, how complete was the cleaning of the data.
Well, of course, a lot of the current concern and scare about projected warming over the next century, which might cause us to make draconian or dramatic changes in our energy policy, a lot of that is based on computer models. And from what I can gather by reading various books, the computer models, of course, are only as good as the assumptions that are put into them. And one of the assumptions in most of the computer models is that there hasn't been any natural climate variability, but rather the climate is stable up until the time that humans start to burn fossil fuels. And that itself is a all of your research, and mine as well, shows that that is not a correct assumption, that we've had very
No, that's contradicted by the past evidence, which is the paleo record. If you take, let's say, whatever reconstruction of the temperatures, let's say, 3,000 years, from 3,000 years back in time, right? Let's say, if there is some impact of human race on the temperature, so then it's certainly, let's say, last 1,000 years, possibly, but not 3,000 and earlier, no way. So then, how would you explain those changes then? Way down then, there, yeah. It must be the action of the solar orbit of the sun.
Yeah, in fact, there's a lot of good research now that about the climate history of the Earth. I've run across some good books recently. One is called Heaven and Earth: Global Warming, the Missing Science, by Ian Plimmer of the School of Earth and Environmental Sciences. Another one is called The Resilient Earth, Science, Global Warming, and the Future of Humanity by Hoffman and Simmons. Mm. Another one is called Global Warming, Unstoppable Global Warming Every 1,500 Years by Singer and Avery.
Oh, yes, yeah, by Fred Singer, yeah.
Yeah, and all of these things talk about the magnitude of climate change which has occurred in the past, over the geological past, and we're talking very, very large changes in climate. Which, of course, were not driven by human activities at all, because a lot of them go way back.
No, we had the researcher here. Unfortunately, he died. Bond was his name. So he strengthened that kind of 1,500 year periodicity, which is generating somewhere in the oceans. Yeah.
Yeah, the Bond cycles.
The Bond cycles.
Right. Well, if we look at I think one of the problems with this issue is that most people don't think in terms of geologic time. They think in terms of a human lifespan, maybe 100 years or less.
Yeah.
And so most people are unequipped to think about, say, what the Earth might have looked like 20,000 years ago when a 1 or 2 mile thick glacier covered pretty much all of Canada and extended to the northern part of the United States. And sea levels were about 100 to 130 meters lower, and the Earth was a very, very different looking place. And they don't understand that during about 80% of the Earth's history, the temperature was considerably warmer.
That's right. There was more ice, and considerably more than today.
So this problem of kind of time perspective or perspective of history is I guess my optimism would be that this whole crazy issue might help educate people about the rates and magnitude of natural environmental change, because people have to know about that now.
Listen, I guess that, let's say, even whatever, 40 years ago, the literature was relatively, relatively frequently mentioning the Milankovic cycles, so-called Milankovic cycles. You know, these are the variations of the sun with respect to the orbit, right, of the orbital plane. And nowadays, you don't even see his name cited in the references on whatever is the work describing the climate changes. Yeah, it's funny.
Do you have a idea why that might be? You think there has been some kind of suppression of a politically incorrect set of facts?
Something like that, maybe. Who knows? You know, I am, of course, you know, I get that Milankovic medal by the European Geophysical Union. But, no, so don't take me too seriously in this respect. But, no, but Milankovic,
we take you very seriously, George.
Was explaining or was trying to explain all these variations of past climates by just natural forces. Yeah, I didn't even consider that maybe that the our production of extra human heat, so to say, would have any impact on the globe. So no wonder that they don't cite him nowadays, especially not when trying to, you know, so turn us back to just paleoclimate to the past experience, you know, when people were just living in the caves, huh?
Yeah.
That would probably be the best way to stop the so-called global warming. Hmm.
Ah, I see. What you're saying is that the best way to stop global warming would be to bring us back to a kind of a Stone Age lifestyle.
Yeah, to go back to Stone Age. Yeah.
Yeah, but the Stone Age lifestyle is a hunter-gatherer.
In the view of the most literature which you read today.
Yeah.
But, of course, yeah, that would be the very wrong assumption. On the other hand, you know, it would probably very little with the changes of climate, with the global warming. It would not stop global warming.
Yeah.
I mean, measured by the globally weighted temperature change.
You like you say, you got the Milutin Milankovic medal from the European Geophysical Union in 2003.
You have
been involved in various organizations. You were at a conference, a climate conference.
No. It's European Geosciences Union.
Okay, Geoscience. Okay. And then you've been involved with the American Quaternary Association and the International Quaternary Association, and I'm sure many scientific groups. How would you look at we hear a lot about consensus nowadays, which, of course, is not really a scientific concept as much as it is a political concept. But your colleagues, What would be the view of most of your colleagues when you go to these conferences regarding the role of humans in the current climate debate?
Well, no, they are many of them are questioning this whole new trend. Yeah. There are thousands of actually. If you look at some of these conferences, they had one now in Chicago, for example, of those so-called deniers. Yeah. Have you seen that book by Solomon?
Yes.
Called Deniers?
Mm-hmm, I've got that book, yeah.
You do, huh?
No. Yes, I have
right,
that.
Yeah. That's a pretty accurate book, yeah. So,
yeah.
So no, it's not such a generally believed understanding
the subtitle to that book is called The Deniers, the World-Renowned Scientists Who Stood Up Against Global Warming Hysteria, Political Persecution, and Fraud. And then there's a asterisk, and it says, and those who are too fearful to do so. So, yeah,
That's the point. Or that not fearful to do so, but maybe even too clever to do so, because the funding, you see, the funding agencies are pretty much influenced by, whether your colleagues give you a good mark for your publications or not. And if you are too many saying, oh, no, this guy this shouldn't be funded. So what can you do?
Well, you gave a talk. In fact, you sent me a copy of a PowerPoint presentation that you gave at a conference in, I believe, Chicago in October. And it's called Misunderstood Global Warming. And it's a very interesting PowerPoint with some great figures. But the point that you're making, I believe, is that yes, we have regular cycles of glacial and interglacial climate, and that has to do with the amount of solar radiation that we receive at different latitudes over time.
That's right, and this is still going on.
Yeah.
This is still going on, and this is still producing the increase of global mean temperature. This is what I didn't strengthen so much earlier, but that's where the conflict is generated, that you have this natural global warming, and then you certainly can prove for some at least small places in the northern hemisphere that indeed the action of man is adding to this global warming.
And then there, at your conclusion, you say future natural outlook, continued global warming marked by increased warming of the tropics, increase of equator to poles temperature gradient, and more vigorous meridional, that's mean north-south circulation, increased precipitation in high latitudes, and growth of polar ice. In other words, continuing global warming will initiate the next ice age.
That's right. Now, it will be, of course, as I mentioned, those long-term cycles, every fourth one, every 400,000 years or whatever, it's relatively weak. So the weakness of the current cycle will, of course, make the advance, the future advance of the glaciers relatively delayed.
Yeah, so what I'm reading is that the prediction of the next ice age or glaciation within, say, 5 to 20,000 years based on the periodicity of past climate cycles.
That's more or less valid still.
Well, if we've got 5 to 20,000
Did you say 25,000 years, not 25 years, no?
I said 5 to 25,000 years.
1,000 years. Okay, good.
Yeah, so our prognosis then as a species and as a planet is really pretty good, because if we're looking looking at another 5,000 years of interglacial climate, that means benign, that means good agricultural long growing seasons, that means lots of opportunities for an economic growth. The fact is,
this impact of CO2 would be very helpful, actually. Yeah.
Because historically, if we look back, even the last 1,000 years, we see that the medieval warm period between about 900 and 13 AD was a little bit warmer, maybe 1 or 2 degrees centigrade, and this was a period of wealth and prosperity in Europe. And the Little Ice Age between about 1400 and 1850 AD, in which the average temperature was decreased by 1 to 2 degrees centigrade, was a period of failure of harvests, starvation, plague. The cold is much worse for humans and other organisms than the warmth is.
Right. Now, if you realize that actually the time that we can, using our excellent models, which are now, you know, the models used for prediction, I don't know how long. So the same models, if you insert in them these Milankovitch basic figures, right? So what they come up with are showing that the optimum part of what we can reconstruct now for the last 10,000 years was actually the time of the lowest temperature, global mean temperature, globally weighted temperature. It was the lowest one.
Now that's a global.
But most of the sunshine was directed to where we happen to live, no, here in the middle and high latitudes. That's it. Therefore, it was so benign.
Ah. Okay, so you almost have to look at the tropical climate and the mid-upper latitude climate as being inversely related.
That's exactly it. Yes.
Okay, so then the Viking expansion period, the medieval warm period, which was a period of warmth between 900 and 1300 AD, and prosperity in the upper and middle latitudes, would have been a slightly cooler climate globally. Is that what you're saying?
I'm not on this kind of relatively very detailed time calendar, so to say. No, so I'm not looking at it this way. No, but might have been. Who knows how the tropics, tropical oceans, how warm, if you would average their temperature, warm temperature, how they behaved in those days. Well, we were looking only on a very small area where we have some historical or whatever information. But you know, if you look at the whole globe, you know, what do you know?
Gentlemen, can I break in here and say this is KHENLPFM Radio 106.9 Salida, Colorado. We're streamed on the internet at khen.org, and TruthQuest programs are archived at www.givemesometruth.info. And my co-host this evening is Dr. Eric Carlstrom, professor of geography at California State University at Stanislaus. And our special guest is George Kukla. And the gentlemen are talking about climate change and related to temperatures, if I'm correct. And I'll let you guys go from there.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we were talking about the medieval warm period between 900 and 1300 AD, for which we have good historical accounts. And
Can I add to it for a very small portion of the global surface?
Yeah.
So you know, we shouldn't think to have data on the global annually average temperature, no way.
Yeah, okay. Well, then my question is, George, can we look at the deep sea cores? Is the resolution of kind of proxy temperature records in the, say, oxygen isotope content of seashells, et cetera, that we might pull from the sea cores or the cores of sediments at the bottom of the ocean? Would we be able to test your hypothesis and look at the deep sea cores to see if the tropical oceans were cooling during the medieval warm period?
Well, in the oceans, again, we have the problem with what area is reflected by it. Furthermore, the resolution in the deep sea cores is not as good. No, we can't go into 10-year or 100-year intervals. No way.
Yeah, and of course, the ice cores won't help because they're at the high latitudes. So we need something.
That's right. Ice cores were elsewhere.
What about lake cores? Would they give us the information we needed at that time period?
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, we may get something from the ice cores. That's a good idea.
The lake cores, yeah. Mm. Because we certainly had lakes at all latitudes. And of course, the lakes have been filling and shrinking and filling and shrinking over time, again, in response to these climate changes. So maybe what we need to do is find an expert on the study of lake sediments over that time period in the tropical latitudes to see what was happening. Would that be a good approach?
You know, another question is, if you look at this kind of historical data and whatever, so what do we know from more recent periods, like the last 100 years or so, how huge was the impact of diseases, you see? For example, of the flu, no? Spanish flu or whatever it was, 1900 and something. So in those days, the farther you go in time, you know, these impacts must have been much more severe.
Yeah.
So, you know, forget the climate, in other words.
And how about the Little Ice Age between about 1400 and 1850, or 1300 and 1850, when we know from historical records that the climate was harsher in the middle and upper latitudes, and therefore European cultures at least suffered greatly in many ways. Wealth declined rather than increased during that time. Do we have an opposite signal in the tropics that you know of, that is to say warming temperatures in the tropics during that time?
Oh, where should I go to look? If you ask this question, tell me, where could I possibly find something like that, some records of those times?
The question is, where do you go to look? I guess there's no culture in the low latitudes that was recording temperature proxy type data. Is that right?
Oh, yeah, right. And keeping it in some readable form, in the scientific papers that I can get in our library. Yeah, that's the question.
Well, okay, so your question then kind of brings up the next question, which is that you do probably, I would assume, an enormous amount of library searching through the journals from many, many different kinds of studies over different time spans. And so much of the kind of research that you do would be based on reviewing the work of other scientists and trying to put the pieces together into a larger scheme. Would that be correct?
Come on, yeah, I'm not doing too much. Anyway, I'm 8 years old.
Well, okay, then I'll say over the course of your career, that has been an approach.
Right. Okay, but whenever I go to any reconstructions deeper in the past, so they are more and more local. And when I want to use these local data that may be very accurate, especially in China, for example, you know, maybe locally very accurate if when it comes to weather extremes, you know, that's the problem, weather extremes. But in order to calculate the average aerially weighted global mean temperature for these times, from unos, three rings, no, like some people try to do it. No way.
Okay, so, yeah, you're bringing up the point that it is very, very difficult. And, of course, the farther back we go in time, the more difficult it is to try to get a one number to describe the average temperature of the Earth.
Oh, it's more of a guess
as we go back.
No way.
Yeah.
I even have questions about if we have enough data, if we are doing it right, even today, with all those weather stations.
Do you suppose this is the reason, then, that the computer modelers who've been working on this for the last several decades, or at least two or three decades, have tended to say, well, climate variability is so complex in the past, and we're uncertain about these.
Maybe.
So maybe they just factor it out and say, well, let's just assume climatic stasis.
That's the climate is stable, That we are the only elements, I mean the human activity is the only one producing any kind of changes, or at least major changes.
Yeah, but based on your career, which has been to study climate changes of the past, you can categorically say that assumption is
stupid,
incorrect.
Yes,
right?
It's incorrect, of course.
Yeah. So, are you saying that some of the modern climate modelers are now trying to introduce these fairly well-known climate cycles into their models?
Did I say that?
Well, you intimated that there was somewhat of an overlap now between the study of El Nino and La Nina and the climate changes over 10 to 15,000 years. So that gave me to believe that maybe some of the...
No. The 1,500 years. No, it was 1,500 years.
Okay.
That was the... No, but they didn't look at the connections with El Nino and La Nina. They didn't have the data that far back.
Okay, so
hey, perhaps... Maybe in El Nino and La Nina, the extreme cases of La Nina were recorded or could be reconstructed, you know, from some lake sediments, for example, in South America. But to make a complete set of no way.
Yeah. So in this situation where we have almost mind-boggling complexity of trying to understand the patterns of climate change in the past, the global, the general circulation models that are produced by our computer modelers then oversimplify dramatically, eliminate the importance of the magnitude and the frequency of natural climate cycles, and then come up with their projections based on a limited set of assumptions such that human use of carbon dioxide becomes the principal forcing factor in temperature. Would that be right?
Something like that. I would add to it another observation that if we are today able to detect that the global mean temperature indeed is going up, right? Warming, and that's the case. That's unquestionable. That's fine. We can't attach it only to the activity of man. On the other hand, a major part, or who knows, a substantial part of the global warming would happen anyway, naturally, okay? Mm. In the orientation of the sun, or the sun's orbit toward the Earth, it should have.
Yeah. Well, just for our listeners, I've got this book, Heaven and Earth, Global Warming, The Missing Science, And on page 234, the author Plimmer talks about known climate cycles. The tectonic cycle is variable. There's a galactic cycle of 143 million years. There's an orbital cycle, three orbital cycles, which are the Milankovitch variations. One is 100,000 years, one is 41,000 years, one is 21,000.
The 41,000 years is the key one, which is really controlling most of the climate. But in the and the combination with the shorter one, with the 23,000, with the precessional cycle, that's important as well, because it accentuates the differences between the tropics and the poles.
Yeah. But then he also mentions higher frequency solar cycles at 1,500 years, which is the Bond cycle that you mentioned, the 210-year solar cycle, the 87-year cycle, which I believe is the Gleisberg cycle, and then the 22 and 11-year sunspot cycles that we know.
Right, So they will all have some impact,
And one more is the 18.6-year lunar cycle. So we have, in these known cycles, we have external forcing mechanisms, variations in the Earth's orbit around the sun, and changes in solar output with known cycles. And none of these are factored into the climate models that I know of, are they?
And many more, which even I don't know, and my colleagues do not.
Well, you still have some association with the Lamont-Doherty Observatory, is that correct?
No, for example, I am calling from here,
Okay,
The office here,
Yeah, and at the Lamont-Doherty Observatory, you have, I think, one of the most complete records of deep-sea cores assembled anywhere in the Earth, isn't that correct?
We have a pretty good collection here, Should I go and check something for you?
No, I'm just trying to give our listeners a sense of what goes on there at that institution. And how many people would be there at the Lamont-Doherty Observatory?
Well, as for the scientists, at least the graduated scientists, or whatever. So over 300, maybe.
300 scientists.
500, maybe.
Wow. And how many of those, just to give a rough idea, would be computer modelers as opposed to what we might call field scientists who go out and actually gather the data?
I would say those who go out and try to find some data occasionally, not all the time, of course. I would say about one-third or half, maybe.
Okay. And of course, this is the tradition that you came from. You were actually working on the Czechoslovakian lust sequence and the Chinese lust sequence, looking at the soils and the pollen and the different climates that are represented by those changes in soils and lust and pollen, et cetera, and trying to put that all into a time frame to understand the timing and the magnitude of climate. I notice there's a big difference between the people who work in the field and those who are pretty much confined to computer models and simulations. Would you say that's the case?
Well, it refers to me, so it must be the case, because I haven't been in the field for quite a while. So, don't take what I say too seriously. Sure, yes. No, but when you are younger, not so, come on. You get to feel it more frequently, natural.
Yeah. Well, and it's also a kind of a
but
factor
now,
of
a good part of really useful discoveries, in science are actually basically produced on computers. So, you are using the data gathered by other people in the field and on all that, but
So you see the positives then in the...
Certain positive aspects in this trend.
Well, I've got a couple PowerPoints and articles that I've got on my website, naturalclimatechange.us. And in one of the first ones I did, I was just basically drawing on the work of meteorologist Roy Stevens. And it's called Limitations of the General Circulation Models. And at the top, I've got models. It is a quote from Anonymous. Models are always wrong, but sometimes they're useful anyway. And then the limitations would include no GCMs can predict the weather more than 5 or 10 days in advance. The models assume a doubling of carbon dioxide despite incomplete understanding of carbon cycle sources and sinks. The models falsely assume the Earth's climate would be stable without human emissions. They don't account for the observed climate cycles or the range of natural climate change observed. They assume climate change will be linear, which is not true. Earth's surface temperatures are skewed by urban heat island and land use changes, maybe overestimating temperatures by 40%. And they incorporate many fudge factors in order to initialize the models, in other words, to conform with observed reality. And the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, admits models are not initialized accurately. They don't adequately account for dampening effects of oceans and sea ice. They have poor spatial resolution. They cannot model clouds adequately. They don't accurately model the negative feedback mechanisms involved in increased cloud cover, moisture, etc., under a warmer climate. These act as a thermostat to regulate and moderate temperatures. And these climatologists say that cloud forcing is 15 to 20 times greater than the 2.5 watts per square meter presently attributed to enhanced greenhouse warming. They don't realistically model atmospheric dust. They don't adequately model diurnal variations in solar radiation, ocean heat capacity, and ocean circulation. They don't accurately model the effects of volcanoes, orbital parameters, such as Milankovitch cycle, solar variability, or the Pacific heat vent. They may not model accurately for the urban heat island and human land use change effects. And finally, CO2 doubling should produce diminishing heating effects, according to some. So the general circulation models, of course, are the basis of the IPCC's projections of climate in the next century, which are supposedly the justification for changing our energy policy with the new energy bill, et cetera, to limit our use of fossil fuels. But with all these problems in the models, perhaps right now no action is warranted. Would you say that's the case?
Not only that, I would say that, listen, from all these points that you have read, so as far as I can tell, so most are all right, and some maybe are questionable. But anyway, the main problem is that it would be not only it would be damaging to make any changes in the going absolutely zero CO2 production or whatever, or blame CO2 for any of these changes which are now happening. That's absolutely unwarranted. No, that would be damaging.
Okay, so to what extent has the media beaten a path to your door to get your views on these things over the last 20, 30 years? For 20 years, let's shall we say, because 20 years, since 1990, we've seen this enormous research push towards funding the global warming hypothesis, the man-caused global warming hypothesis.
What newspapers are you working for?
I'm not working for any newspaper. I'm just asking you.
What do you ask? You know how the newsmen are. Oh, come on.
What is the role of the media in this, then? What would be your perception?
Very negative. If they got some line, which they decide to follow, so that's it. And whether it's correct or not, that's another question. Now, there are some relatively useful, so to say, useful more careful reporters, you know, on the problem of global warming, but there are not too many now, unfortunately.
Well, I find it interesting that in the little introduction I read about you from Wikipedia, that you were one of the original scientists who brought the issue of climate change to the political arena, Nixon administration, et cetera, and then the fear was that a cooling world could cause problems, and now we've switched to the potential problems of warming. Do you have any sense of that whole why that this thing reversed itself so completely, so that there's not any memory of what happened back in the 70s?
Listen, the problem is that back in the 70s and whatever, we were flooded. Whatever information we had was, most of the information was referring to the middle and the high latitudes. And middle and the high latitudes, indeed, on the longer run, are kind of having this cooling trend. However, we didn't realize that, let's say, 50% of the global area is between 30 north and 30 south latitude, okay? And that were completely opposite and partly unknown changes are taking place. You know, we didn't take it into consideration earlier. We were too much poolwards oriented. Is that understandable?
Well, I mean, there does seem to be some logic and sense in the government, various government agencies examining the question of the impacts of climate change, because this talks about future food security, et cetera. But when all our studies show that cooling is more damaging than warming, why has the media and the government officials locked onto global warming as the fear instead of the equally possible, equal likelihood of the impact of global cooling? I mean, it seems like they almost flipped the coin.
No. We should stop. Listen, if we really would like to do something useful, so we should stop looking at these global weighted annual whatever averages. It's useless.
Okay, useless. So you're saying that just look at if we stop doing that, if we stop looking at the global weighted average temperature, then the debate's over, isn't it?
Maybe you can look at it, but then in order to change it, you know, if we don't even know for sure what's causing the differences or the changes, so it's naive. Naive, that's the point.
Melody, do you have some questions you'd like to ask?
Yeah, I have. Right now, I'm kind of curious on the fact that it's almost sounding like that the science isn't there to back up either of these arguments. Is that what I'm hearing?
Melody, unfortunately, it's very difficult to understand.
I'm sorry, I don't.
Yeah, I can translate.
A miserable connection.
Yeah, Melody is saying that it seems to her that maybe the science is not solid enough to back up either scenario of rapid warming or rapid cooling or catastrophic warming or catastrophic cooling.
She's probably right, yeah.
So we've taken an issue which shouldn't be in the political arena and the economic arena, and yet we've put it in the political and economic arena. going way beyond the science. I guess that's what she's saying. Is that correct?
That's what I'm saying, yeah. I mean, that's what I'm asking, so.
Right.
Oh, you are saying that, no?
Yeah.
Yes. Maybe you are right.
One thing I'm wondering, would, say like the Gulf oil spill, would any of that be affecting the temperature change, any temperature changes in the ocean, and would that have an effect on what you were talking about today?
I already realized that the oceans which never, the part of the oceans which don't freeze, no, over and whatever, and don't change through this year too much, is about 70% of the globe. So that's the weight, no, the weight which comes into computation of the global mean temperature. The changes.
Okay, so the tectonic movement, or the activated tectonic activity that's going on right now, would that have a huge effect on this temperature?
No, it's minor.
Okay.
As I look at the data from the last 50 years or 60 years, you know, I'm just looking now at the, no. So, no. Actually, did I send this slide to Eric, or didn't I? Where there these major volcanic explosions are marked, and no. It's not showing the real impact, no.
So you're saying that the potential climate forcing factor of volcanism is not so great. Is that what you're saying?
It's not affecting the global mean temperatures annually. I mean aerially weighted temperatures. Too much. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
It has impacts, of course, but the problem is once you start looking at the data of the average figures for the whole globe and all years and so on.
Well, just as a kind of a general question, it seems to me that our understanding of the climate system over time has increased many fold since perhaps you started your research and before since I started my research. So the good news is that our understanding of climate change, even though it's incomplete, is exponentially greater than it was, say, 20 or 30 or 40 years ago.
You are correct. And it's whatever we know today, if we look at the data really carefully, so it's strongly supporting the so-called Milankovitch concept of these early boys. Tyndall was the first one probably who started 150 years ago. So, no, those guys who look at the sun as the main changer of climate conditions on the Earth. So that's still going on. That's still obvious in the data which we are collecting today.
Yeah, the work of Svens Mark and Fritz Christensen in Denmark showing the importance of the solar magnetic output as a indirect measure of the amount of cosmic rays that come into the Earth's atmosphere.
Or some minor details, yeah, but yeah, that has the impact as well.
So solar output itself, the cyclical changes in the actual output of the sun, you would say.
No, wait. That's not the main variable. The main variable is the so-called obliquity, and obliquity is the measure of the solar, the position of the sun with respect to the equator, going from southern winter to northern winter, or southern summer to northern summer. You know, with the angle at June, at the 23rd or June or whatever it is where the how high over horizon is the sun shining on the poles. Yeah.
Right.
So
yeah.
Have we had axis shift, and is that what you're saying is the major contributing factor that would affect it then?
That's right. That's okay. The major controlling factor, not contributing, it's controlling.
Okay.
And let me just kind of reiterate for people the what the obliquity cycle is. This is the 41,000-year cycle in which the Earth's the tilt of the Earth's rotational axis varies from now we're 23.5 degrees.
That's
off
right.
Of the perpendicular to the orbital plane or the ecliptic of the Earth's orbit around the sun.
But at the beginning of the warmest, you know, the warmest part of the last 10,000 years, the angle was 24 and something, 24.2, I guess.
Yeah, and so this axial tilt
The other hand, right. On the other hand, the angle at the beginning of the last glaciation 115,000 years ago was 22 and something. So that's looking like a very small change, but no, it has in the calculation of the energy received by, especially by the tropics, is very significant, and high latitudes as well. The difference between the warm the warm oceans in the tropics and the cold, relatively cold poles is very much controlled by this obliquity.
Yeah, and what causes the glaciers to grow or to recede is the amount of solar radiation focused at the high latitudes, such as 60 degrees north, where we have a lot of...
Well, they don't care about the solar radiation. They care about the water which they are getting from the atmosphere in the form of snow, which is growing them, yeah. And for the water to get into the atmosphere, you have to evaporate it from somewhere, from the warm water. Relatively warm water. How else can you grow the glacier?
So go ahead, Melody.
So pole shifts would be something that we need to be more concerned about, as to how the sun hits these areas, and would cloud cover have a huge factor?
Well, that's my point. Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Yeah, many of the authors of books that are coming out now say the clouds are incredibly important, both as a positive feedback mechanism and a negative feedback mechanism, to either enhance or to dampen these natural cycles. And
sure,
the clouds are a wild card. They are very, very hard to model. We have different kinds of clouds. We have high-level clouds and low-level clouds and medium-level clouds. And they all behave a little bit differently in terms of what they do to not only temperature, but precipitation. And precipitation is another factor.
Exactly, yeah, right. Yeah, basically, the movement was of water, no, through the system.
Yeah. So when you talk about the movement of water, you're talking about the clouds, you're talking about the evaporation, that's right.
And the reception of the... And what is... Actually, the clouds are pretty much... controlling, you know, how much of the solar energy will come down to the surface and so on. No, it's bloody complicated.
Well, it certainly is. And of course,
if you go into the detail now, so the danger is that you will look at some of those major secondary, additions to the complexity as being very important. And no, you have to realize that all that is working in combination. You know, you can't separate one or the other. But still, there are these principles. I'm sorry to repeat it again, the principle Milankovic cycles, which up to now seem to work well.
Yeah. Well, we have also done, I think, a lot of work on understanding the atmospheric circulation system and the ocean circulation system. And we know that these respond very radically to changes from glacial to interglacial or even interstadials to stadials, and that we get a complete reorganization of the atmospheric and ocean circulation systems between these extremes of glacial and interglacial. So this would be a factor as well, right?
Yeah, furthermore, listen, when we come to the ocean, we are looking at the circulation at the surface of the ocean, and we are forgetting very poor knowledge about what's happening at the levels of the intermediate deeper ocean, you know, for example, the so-called underwater banks, you know, where the water flow may be, the deep water flow may be modified very, very significantly, and the same in Asia.
So you're saying that the surface ocean is what may be the largest contributing factor, and what is it?
No. It's the receptor of the solar energy, yeah?
Okay. And so that circulation is what affects a lot of this, what you're talking about, correct?
That's correct. But still, we have to realize that there is the movement of the energy within the sea is not only the one at the surface. You know, it may be much considerably. Of course, it's the strongest probably, but there is a strong one at the deeper levels as well, and we know very little about those effects.
So you don't know.
Furthermore, we know very, very little, and we are kind of forgetting it on the very long time scale, longer time scale than those 100,000 years or whatever. The tectonic ones, you know, the tectonic moving, changing the shape of the mountains, of the mountain belts, and so on. Those were, again, very, very important contributors to the climate.
Okay, then that's where, again, where I'm was bringing that question about the tectonic movement that's so highly activated right now, and specifically in certain areas of the world, may be that major contributing factor, or wild card that we don't have much knowledge about. Is that kind of what?
No. Again, okay. No, we think that on these let's say just 10 years, 100 year periods, they are not very important. Are important? Not at all.
Okay.
But what I say is that we look at whatever is above the sea level, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where we can do the measurements, where we can come and look at the mountain and so on. I don't know exact figure, but Mount Everest is, for example, growing by several centimeters, you know, 10 years or whatever. So, you know, if you project it on longer time scales, so it may be important how the Himalayas, for example, changed in time, or how the Alps, alpine changes, which are in Europe, or our mountain ranges here in the U.S., you know, are blocking the western part from the east, the circulations. So how those changed in time. So, you know, on the several hundred thousand year time scales, that may be important as well.
George, do you have some insight into the kind of the hot button issues that have been kind of, I would say, concocted around the anthropogenic global warming scare, such that the glaciers are melting, the sea level is rising, the polar bears are dying, the hurricanes are increasing, number of tropical infectious diseases distribution is increasing. There's a whole series of kind of scare tactics that are associated with this issue. I think any of which can be questioned and most of which can be refuted. Do you have an insight into some of those?
Or I would have a recommendation to give most of the newsmen a chance to get a very good feeding in mental hospitals so that they would like to join the crowd there and stop working on these scary stories. Yeah.
In other words, I think there's plenty of evidence that the sea level is not rising much at all and not at a faster rate than it has been over the past, well, since 18...
Correct.
The past few hundred years.
Correct.
We've come out of the Little Ice Age, the sea level has been rising at the rate of about 4 to 6 inches a century.
But listen, if we are on these longer Milankovitch cycles somewhere, so we are still considerably behind the what would be the point at which start worrying about the next glaciation. But we are certainly not on the opposite way.
Yeah,
we are not going into any super interglacial, super warming or whichever way they call it. Some catastrophe, warming catastrophe.
Yeah, in fact, if we look at kind of geological reconstructions of sea level over, you know, the last 600 million years or so, we see that sea level has been considerably higher for most of that time period. And even if we look at the last 500,000 years, in the diagram that you sent me in your PowerPoint, reconstructions of sea level show higher sea levels. This is, I think, Walbrook et al.'s 2002 article in Quaternary Science Reviews. It shows higher sea levels during the last interglacial about 120,000 years ago, maybe as much as, well, here they show maybe almost 10 meters higher. I've elsewhere read 2 to 3 meters higher.
Well, listen, these people are trying to do with the data that they are able to gather, so to do their best, you know, but... If you would carefully check any of these data points, so you know, there are questions.
Yes. Yeah, there's always interpretation involved.
Very much so.
Yes.
Right.
But my point is that in this diagram that you've got, or that Walbrook et al. Have in 2002 for the last half a million years.
Oh, yes. Oh, no. That's a really good one, yeah.
Yeah, the point is that during previous interglacial periods, sea level was higher than present, and of course, human beings were not driving cars or burning fossil fuels. So
let me check on my computer the diagram again. But I guess you are right. Yeah, right.
And these come from dating of corals and speleothems in the red bars.
Those are not the models; those are the observations. Yes.
Yeah.
So what would they attribute the rise of the sea and what to the rise of the sea or the decline of it?
What's causing it? No, that's the inverse measure of growth of the ice, global ice.
Okay.
So when there's less ice in the ice caps in Greenland and Antarctica?
Yeah, in the ice caps, of course, you know, a little bit of ice here and there doesn't make too much of a difference. But no, basically in the Greenland and Antarctica especially.
Yeah, 90% of the world's ice is in Antarctica, and only 4 or 5% is in Greenland. So what's happening in Antarctica is extremely important.
Yeah, on the other hand, the relative change, you know, growth of ice and or disappearance of ice in this warmer and colder intervals is much more dependent on Greenland. And, and Antarctica is pretty much stable in that mm-hmm. respect.
So you got the answer to your question, Melody, that when the sea level is higher, there's less ice on the land, and when there's more ice on the land, there's lower sea level.
Yeah, but what about inland lakes and that sort? Didn't we also have a lot of inland seas that could have been isolated? That could have affected those levels, or am I incorrect in that assumption?
I would probably need the translation from Eric.
Well,
such a miserable connection.
I'm really sorry, and I don't know.
Well, you know, her question has to do with the growth and decay of inland seas, and I think I could maybe translate that to put it in terms that maybe a quaternarist such as yourself, we might translate that to pluvial lakes, which expanded during the last phases of the glacial periods. When the ice is melting and the climate is cool and there's less evaporation. For instance, Nevada was covered with many lakes, 12 to 20,000 years ago. These would be pluvial lakes. So I think what she's asking is about those.
Mm. These are the changes in the lakes are best known and best dated and are actually major in toward the end of the the ice episode, 100,000 years or whatever. So that's connected with the major change in the distribution, the movement, you know, of the sunshine toward closer to the high latitudes. Yeah. So the whole circulation system, yeah, it's affecting the land is changing, shifting. And it's especially well pronounced toward the end of the glaciation.
I have one other question: is would there have been any celestial bodies other than the sun that played a part in this?
That's an excellent question, Melody, and I'll translate. Were there any celestial bodies other than the sun that played a part in the climate change?
Well, probably yes, but. Come on. It's quite possible.
Yeah,
there is at least from the literature that I am hitting here at Lamont, so I didn't get any which would indicate something like that.
Okay.
Well, as a kind of a general indication about how opinions vary amongst the experts, and I mean real experts. There are people that I know, such as my father, Dr. Thor Karlstrom, who, since his studies in the glacial history of Alaska, has posited that it's a combination of the Milankovitch long-term cycles and the lunar short-term cycles that were elucidated by a scientist named Pedersen, a Norwegian scientist, back in Norway in the early part of the 20th century. And he posited lunar cycles or tidal cycles of about 256 and 550 and 1100 years. And then subsequently, Thor, my father, has also identified a half cycle of the 256-year cycle in the alluvial record in the American Southwest. So he thinks that you have a series of harmonic cycles at higher frequency that are based on variations in the gravitational force exerted by the mostly by the moon on the Earth. And this would affect not only the tides of the ocean, but also, to some extent, the atmospheric tides and even Earth tides. So that this could be an important factor in the future of our understanding of the cyclical nature of climate change. So that's why I say I thought it was an excellent question.
No. He's, of course, no, he's very right. I guess he's probably very right. But those are, on my time scales, you know, those are relatively minor impacts. Because, as I say, you know, if you don't take 10,000 years, so it's a minute for my looking at the climate. It's very short.
Yeah.
No. So he actually was very right in looking those on these additional impacts of like moon and so on.
So then we can start to look at the whole system as a three-body system: the Earth, Moon, and the Sun. And see,
not only come on, who knows? Because there are even additional, more distant planets now, which also would have some effect. Right.
That's probably
no,
true.
But these are, of course, it would be an improvement looking at the moon and with respect to sun and so on, and the Earth, at least. At the moon into the computations, yeah, that would be. And listen, I'm absolutely sure that these NASA people sitting down in Washington, they know that very well, and especially those sitting down in Houston. So before they send anybody out on the moon, no, or wherever, so they know all these long-term cycles. How come that nothing is coming from them published?
Interesting.
Yeah, very interesting question. Do we see perhaps, George, a little bit of a kind of a concealment of scientific information by maybe certain elements of the government? Or do we see an agenda which would then require that the scientific information be edited for public consumption, so that...
No, nothing like that. Listen, these guys are too busy to be useful. Come on. They are not interested in our stupid questions on what happens in 100-year, 1,000-year cycles. Not at all.
Well, Jim...
They know.
But the, like you say, the information is not widely disseminated. It's not that the press is not talking about it.
They don't have time for some stupid whatever conferences. No way. No, they are working.
Well, actually, I've been catching here and there, and I don't know if there's any validity to it or not. But that it's something that's been circulated among the military community, that there may be something celestial that might affect the water levels in the near future. I don't know, but I have heard numerous people out there speaking of that sort of thing. And whether that would affect the climate or be more something that NASA would be paying attention to or not paying or not and not talking about. Just something to throw in there.
I will need the translation.
Well, she's talking about a kind of a orientation towards by the military the importance of changing water levels due to changing in climate. I would say certainly climate has a direct bearing on water issues as well as agricultural issues, the economy. When I gave my final exam to my introduction to physical geography students this last, just a couple of weeks ago, I asked students to speculate a little bit about this, and one of my students said something to the effect that, well, okay, even if there was really good hard evidence of what the future climate was going to be, there probably would be certain individuals who would want to keep a hold of that information so that they could profit by it on the stock market or something like that, so they could invest wisely. In other words, so that information might not be shared widely.
Now, and my point was to say that, you know, maybe NASA does have information that they could or may not be withholding, and it was in reference to something from a celestial body that may affect this water level.
So. Now, listen. Okay, be very careful with those data on the global changes of the average, ocean level. That's very much affected by the tectonic movements of the continents and of the station where these measurements are taken, and it's very unreliable.
Okay. Well, gentlemen, I think it's gotten to close to the end here, and I just like to offer your chances to make any closing comments. And I also want to thank you, George, for coming on our program and having a very interesting interview.
And I would also like to thank you, George. It's been very informative and interesting. And like Melody says, she archives these interviews on her website, and I also archive some of them on my website on www.naturalclimatechange.us.
Can you give me the addresses of those websites?
Mine is www.naturalclimatechange.us.
Okay, and then I would like to again thank you, gentlemen, and hopefully we could do this again sometime, and thanks again.
Okay, and if there are any changes, substantial changes in climate, I will let you know.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much again, both of you, Melody and George.
So bye.
Okay, bye.
Okay. Take care,
enjoy
bye.
Enjoy the weather.